Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today. Let's talk about insects and bugs, and we'll bring in Phil Pelletieri, our UW-Madison professor and entomologist at the Insect Diagnostic Lab at the UW-Madison. Phil, it's a pleasure to see you once again.
Nice to be here, Jim.
I wonder what all of this rain that's been coming in the southern two-thirds of the state is doing into the insect kingdom.
Well, it's turned some things on 180 degrees. I mean, with the drought conditions, we worried about things like spider mites and chinch bugs and the like. And with this weather, it honestly shuts them down. But then, of course, there's other insects that will take advantage of it. And I think the one that's obvious to most of us is that we're going to see a good emergence of mosquitoes. It's ongoing already now. And, the last three or four summers have been unusually dry, at least in the growing season, which means the mosquitoes have been really well below normal. And so now it's going to be a little hard for people to adjust to what it's like going out at dusk when the hordes of mosquitoes are coming to visit. So,
if you'd like to join the conversation with your questions about insects and bugs, all you have to do is give us a call in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, we're toll-free at 800-642-1234. I heard the cicadas the other day when it wasn't raining in the afternoon. Let's say it was 2 days ago. The cicadas were really singing up a storm. This is not to be confused with any part of a 17-year cicada cycle.
Yeah, we have eight species of cicadas that have been recorded in the state. Two of them are the 17-year variety, and the other six some of them are dog day cicadas, and other ones belong to a different genus. And it's interesting, you can identify the cicadas by their singing. And there's one called a scissors grinder, which is not real frequent in Wisconsin, a little more common south of us, that has this really up and down type of singing, whereas the more typical dog day cicada that we have here has more of a constant buzz. If anybody's interested, there's just a delightful site at the University of Michigan on cicadas, and it has pictures of the various species, but it also has the songs. And so I would encourage people to go and investigate that because, as I said, you can identify the critter by what sound it is. And depending where you grew up in the country, there are different cicada songs in different parts of the country.
All right. The calls are coming in, and we'll get to those in just a moment. You were getting reports, lots of reports of deer ticks, wood ticks early this summer. What's happening now in terms of wood ticks and deer ticks and Lyme disease?
We're kind of out of the woods for wood ticks because they tend to really start to drop out by the early part of July. We're in the nymphal stage of the deer tick in this part of the summer. And what makes that one a little bit of a stinker, it's smaller, and so it's more easily overlooked. If you look at Lyme cases, we won't have a good picture until well into March of what happened in the 2007 season, but it continues to increase in cases. I mean, it's just this slow, constant rise, and there's no reason to believe that to change. And again, as we talk about, in early October, the new adult deer ticks will be coming out. But basically, the deer tick season is anytime there is no snow on the ground. And so people who spend a lot of time outdoors, especially more in the western side of the state, although, what we've been seeing lately in the last 4 or 5 years is a pickup of activity up in the Sheboygan area, a pickup of activity down in Walworth County. And so we're seeing more and more activity on the east side, but still the higher numbers are on the west side of the state.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest, and let's take some calls. Let's go to Dennis first in McWanago. Dennis, what's on your mind today?
Well, I've lived in southern Wisconsin almost my entire life, and I've never, ever seen a praying mantis. And all of a sudden, in like a week's time, I stumbled across two of them. So is that kind of like something that's not common around here, or I've never seen them for some reason?
Well, people used to buy, and still you can buy, mantid egg masses and bring them in. And what typically happened previously is they would freeze out in the winter. But now we have convinced ourselves with the mild winters that we are getting breeding populations. There are two common species. Neither of them are native. There's a European mantid and a Chinese mantid, and it was most likely one of those. But they have established, and we know we've got breeding populations now in parts of Wisconsin and parts of Iowa, which, again, is something that 10 years ago we didn't see, and we do equate it to the milder winters that keep coming at us.
There you go.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Dennis, thanks very much for the call. If you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Julia in Wauwatosa. Hello, Julia.
Good morning, Dr. Pelletieri and Jim. I have a question about wasps, and they're terrorizing my hummingbirds. And they're, I think they must weigh as much as a hummingbird. They're black with white stripes, larger than a yellow jacket, fatter. Mm-hmm. And they have an awful temper, and they're hard to hit. So if you swing at them, of course, you can take the hummingbird feeder down, and then they get really angry, and so you strike and miss and run. And I had corpses, but they got washed away by the rain, so I thought this is my opportunity to ask you if you can give me some information on those and how I may be rid of them.
Sure. I'm suspicious it's ball-faced hornet, which is the largest paper wasp that we have, and they are black with a creamy white marking, both on the face. That's where the name comes from. And they do some scavenging on sweets, not near as much as German yellow jacket. And the one thing, I guess, is there are some hummingbird feeders that just make the sugar water too accessible. And so what you may consider is buying a different feeder. That makes it impossible for the yellow jackets to get or wasps to get the sugar water, but yet when the hummingbird comes in, it can still feed. And unfortunately, I don't know which designs, but if you do some investigating, that the ones that identify themselves as kind of being bee-proof are the direction you want to go in. This is a common problem in the late summer because, again, the yellow jackets and hornets tend to do a lot of scavenging, and once they get used to coming into an area for food, they keep coming back. They know where it is, and so they said the adjustment is to provide a feeder that doesn't give them the sugar water they're looking for.
Yeah, and my feeders have deep flowers on them that are supposedly they're not supposed to be able to get into them, but they're pretty creative because they're so voracious. I was wondering if there was, I have three feeders and they seem to stay on one, so I thought, well, I'll just leave it out there so they don't find the others. And I was wondering if there's some sort of a nest I could look for that would be visible.
Well, this is the one that makes the very large nests in the tree. So it's an aerial nest, but it sometimes is 20 feet high in a tree, and they could easily be 100 yards or more away. And so if you're lucky enough to find it, the question is it going to be accessible enough to treat? Now, on the other hand, if you really want to spend some time at this, what you could do is to at least try to track them when they're done feeding, get a general direction of which way they're going, and maybe that may be able to help you, especially if it's close by, find it. But the other thing that I do know people have played with, and this is more with the ground nesters, is to put out a plate with some kind of sugary pop. And when they come in, again, use this tracking device, but if you kind of lose sight of them, 40 yards away, then you move the plate over to that spot and use this as a way of trying to identify where the nest is. It does take quite a bit of time, but honestly, it is effective. But again, my fear with this particular one, because it does build its nest above ground, it may be so high it's just not going to be practical to go after the nest.
Is that what I might call a paper wasp, where they take the leaves and they...
Yes, it is a paper wasp.
Oh, it is a paper wasp. Right. Okay. I didn't quite catch what you told me it was.
The term yellow jacket wasp and paper wasp honestly can all refer to the same critter. They're not really well defined. Bee is something totally different to an entomologist, but a yellow jacket could be a wasp, and it is also a paper wasp. And again, this is the one that makes these huge basketball or larger size nests up in the trees.
All right, so we have lots of trees, so we're not apt to find them.
All right.
But anyway, that helps me. So I'll just keep feeding them on the feeder that they like, and they'll be gone in winter. So.
All right, Julia, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. And Joyce and Madison, let's give you a chance to get in. Go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I have a bug that I've found in my house, and there are, I've seen like three or four now, and they look like... large ants with wings, and they sting. In fact, they got stung by one the other day.
Okay.
And I'm wondering if you might know what they are.
I would guess that they're probably a little spider wasp, because they are very ant-like in their looks, but
yep.
They do have the stinger. And spider wasps, as their name implies, goes out and paralyze spiders, and then they put these in little tube-like channels, and sometimes that turns out to be people's weep holes in their windows or the like, and lay their eggs. Their grubs develop without the wasp taking care of it, so it's not a true nest when we think about a nest of a bumblebee. It's we call them a solitary wasp. But then what happens is when the grubs develop and the new wasps come out, sometimes they get mixed up, so they come indoors rather than outdoors. But I'm guessing your problem is from your windows, and that's where I would look at And again, they're not real aggressive, but if you touch one, they can sting. There's no question about it. And
yeah. Huh, that's interesting because I've never seen them, and I'm sure that's where they're coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Just from the window. So, well, thank you very much. That answers my question.
All right, Joyce, thank you very much for your call. And if you'd like to join in, the number is 263-1890 in Madison or toll-free at 800-642-1234. We mentioned at the top of the hour that bed bugs were back with a vengeance, and they were common in Wisconsin and the United States in the 1940s. What happened then?
Well, it seems that when DDT became registered, it really was the demise of the bed bug. And you know, I talked to people that were on the campus at that time and said that they had issues until the product came, and then it became a non-issue, so much so that people, you know, didn't really believe they exist. And it's interesting. We have a couple species associated with bats and chimney swifts. So, you know, we've seen those species before, but I had not seen a human bed bug probably in the first 10 years of my career. But as people have seen on the news and the newspapers, it really has taken off. And what we equate this to more than anything else is they have a built-in resistance to the standard insecticides that are used indoors. And so when those materials only kill 70% of the population, the 30% that remain are there to keep breeding. And it's gotten to a point now where there are very few problems that I think require professional help. This is one. I really don't think it's in the realm of the average homeowner to be able to deal with this. In most cases, in rental properties, the standard lease requires the landlord to treat for this. And in many of the companies that come out to treat will tell you they have to come out three or four times, and they have to be very good at what they do to get this under control. And again, the problem is more that we don't have the tools anymore that are effective. And part of this does go back to the fact that probably about 95% of the products that are used indoors for pest control are from the same chemical family. There just are no alternatives as far as rotating chemicals, and that's why the resistance came. So until we see some new products developed, I expect this to continue to be an issue. And again, people who never thought there was such a thing as bed bug, unfortunately, may experience it when they travel or whatnot of running into them.
Back to the phones, we go to Judy in Marinette. Judy, what's on your mind today?
Hi. Every year I get a nest. The wasp or yellow jacket eats through the cement wall of my house, and I have everything blocked off, screened off, and everybody tells me my house is really tight or whatever. But they come in, and now they build a 3 by 2 foot nest in my crawl space last year. And this year, every year I get one, and this year I have a different one. It's a smaller yellow and black bee or wasp, and they came in through a piece of siding down into the cinder block and ate through the wall in my lower level. And I was wondering what I would have that's attracting these in every year.
Well, there's something not structurally correct with your cinder block and the like, because although these things are capable of moving a little bit of stuff, if you have an intact piece of cement or block, I can't see them digging their way through. If there's some kind of weakening, though, then they can. And you know, what they're looking for typically in nature is, you know, an old gopher burrow or something that's pre-dug, and they kind of take it over. And we do see them commonly getting into wall voids and attic spaces if there's some kind of opening in the siding. And so, as I said, if they're getting through the cinder block, I wonder if the mortar is just weakening enough and starting to crack and open, because if it was intact, I they're not capable. They just don't have the kind of jaws or leg strength or whatnot to be able to go through sound concrete or sound block.
In the back of the house, when they got into the crawl space under my house, which is 4 foot tall, under my house, they came through a part that doesn't have the siding on it. It's cement. So there were they found a hole where they were coming in. So that cement could be breaking down too.
Yes. I mean, basically, the there has to be a pre-existing hole or big structural weakness for them to get at it.
Okay. I have somebody that comes in and checks my house every spring. The other thing I do is I hang out wasp traps around my fences. Is that bringing them in? Because they go in there and they die.
Yeah. No, what you're killing are the sterile female workers. But the way all these work, whether they're bumblebees or yellow jackets, is in the spring, queens go out and search for these kind of cavities to make their nests. And then once they find it, They start raising their young. And for the first 2 months, the numbers are so low, it doesn't catch anybody's attention. It's usually well into July or not August when we're starting to talk about hundreds of individuals in a nest that all of a sudden people are aware of it. And then these things will continue to be active until we get into at least the second or third good frost. And then everything starts from scratch again the next year. And it sounds unfortunately that they continue to find good places to move in your place because they don't reuse the old nests that are there.
Oh, they don't. Okay, no. I had an exterminator come in and pour some kind of powder and a liquid down into the hole in the wall.
Mm-hmm.
And there hasn't been any activity. There were 30 that we counted that were down in the lower level. But there hasn't been any noise coming. Would that mean the nest is dead now?
Yeah, what I usually find after you treat, and to be honest, I find that dusts are the best way to treat these going in the hole or ground types of nests. If you treat it and you go out there the next day, you know, and it's halfway sunny out, they should be coming and going gangbusters. So if you see no activity, they're done.
Oh, okay, and I can have the hole closed up.
Right.
Yes.
But you did it exactly the way that you need to, is you make sure the nest is treated. One of the worst calls I get in this time of the year is people that had a nest and they plug it up without treating it. And then I have literally seen the wasps eat their way through wallboard. Nothing thicker than that, but wallboard isn't that thick. And when you have 200 or 300 individuals, there's enough to do that. And then we've got problems because we've got lots of angry wasps in the house and we don't have access to the nest. And I tell them, you got to find the nest and treat it. So in those cases, I honestly tell people to open up whatever they plugged, let them have access outside, and then treat it from the outside to take care of it.
How long do I have to wait before I can close the outside?
Oh, if they're not active in a day, you can close it the next day.
Okay. Is there a special kind of material to use, like some kind of kit I can buy, or you just caulk it up?
Just caulk it up would be fine.
Caulk is fine. Oh, you've been so helpful. Thank
you. All right, Judy, thanks a lot. We appreciate hearing from you. Our guest is Phil Pelletieri. He's a UW-Madison professor of entomology, and he hangs out at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us this morning on the Ideas Network. I'm Jim Packard, in for Larry Mueller, and we're talking with Phil Pelletieri about insects and bugs. And let's go to Dan in Eau Claire. Hi, Dan. What can we do for you?
Jim and Phil, thank you for the most informative hour on radio. I really appreciate it. I'd like you to talk about the deer tick and its whole life cycle. I just went through a 4-year hell with Lyme's disease. The tests they're doing are documented junk, is what I've read on the internet. And I seriously suggest people suffering from neurological disorders, joint pain, things like that, to go to the doctor and literally demand the antibiotics. That's what I had to do, and it's changed my life. I can go back to work now. But please tell more about the deer tick, because I didn't even have a clue that I had Lyme's disease.
Mm-hmm. And this has been an interesting story. You know, it's one of these things that's kind of unfolded in my career, and I've always been very intrigued. The first deer tick was discovered in Wisconsin in 69. And to be honest, we call it the black-legged tick is the official name. And the student that found it published on it because it was such an odd place to find it in northwest Wisconsin, whereas the tick was normally found down in Texas. And so that's before Lyme disease was really known. And then as things unfolded in the 70s and the like, and the high incidence of rheumatoid arthritis in children in New England, they investigated and found that this indeed was a disease that ticks were giving to people. And what the disease is a mouse disease. The spirochete that's involved with this is found in white-footed mice and other wildlife, but they white-footed mice seem to be the most important. So the deer tick seems, for whatever reason, and I don't have a good explanation, has really spread both in New England and in Wisconsin and now into parts of Illinois and Iowa and in Minnesota. And the tick has a 2-year life cycle. The eggs are laid when a female has gotten a blood meal. If you've ever seen it on your dog, they get as big as a large bean, and they will lay literally up to a couple thousand eggs. These hatch, and the first stage is called a larvae, and it's a very tiny tick that only has 3 pairs of legs. Most ticks should have 4 pairs, but the immature larvae do not. And they are clean at that point in their life. They primarily feed on rodents. In fact, most of them hardly have a mouth part big enough to feed into people. I occasionally see it, but they really don't do well on people. But when they feed on the rodent, that gives them the opportunity to pick up the disease. And so after feeding for a few days and taking the blood meal, they fall off. They transform into the second life stage, which is called the nymph. The nymph does have four pairs of legs, but it's very small. It's a little bit smaller, about the size of a sesame seed, and a little smaller than that. And the nymph is most active in the middle of the summer, or from late spring into early fall. And it's interesting, when you look at Lyme disease cases in people, there's a correlation that most people acquire the disease in the middle of the summer. And what we've always equated this to is that the ticks are small enough that they're more easily overlooked, and people are not aware that they are being bit by the tick. Again, the nymphs will feed primarily on rodents, but will feed on larger mammals. And if they're successful in finding a blood meal, they transform into the adult. And this whole process takes 2 years. So they only feed three times in their life. What you find then is the larvae do not have the disease. The immature nymphs often run around 7 to 8% on average, although we do have some pockets that are higher than that. And the adults run double that in the case of carrying the spirochete that causes Lyme disease. The reason it's double that is they fed twice on mice, so they have twice the opportunity. Now, you may have picked up that we really preach that if you're in an area that has ticks, and what's interesting about this tick, this is definitely an outdoor tick. This is definitely a tick you got to go in the woods to find. We do not find it in urban environments. We do not find it indoors, typically. But if you go into areas that have these ticks anytime in when there's no snow on the ground, you should consider putting personal protection, the sprays for your clothing, you know, wearing long sleeve shirts and kind of cutting down as much exposed skin. And I'm more of a proponent for the permethrin clothing sprays than I am the DEET for your skin. The reason is permethrin kills them, whereas DEET just repels them. Although DEET does a very good job, permethrin I think is better. Now, the tick apparently takes at least 24, some people will say as much as 48 hours of feeding on you before it transmits the spirochete into your body. That's why we talk about the tick checks, that if you remove the tick the same day it was on your person, it doesn't matter if it's infective or not. But the problem then is when you get Lyme disease, initially the symptoms are often flu-like, body aches, fevers that come and go. There may or may not be a rash associated with it. People often will write this off to, you know, eating something bad or, you know, just not correlating it that was related to the tick. And then you get these secondary problems that can be neurological, muscular, the arthritis type problems. And then it becomes very difficult to pin it down. In fact, you know, I think the medical community would argue that a lot of those are autoimmune responses. It's your body fighting back that's causing the problems as much as anything. What makes it quite difficult on the physical side is if you do a blood test, they're looking for antibodies in your blood. It's very difficult, if not impossible, to find the organism. So one of the questions that comes up is if you were sick and we treated you and you feel better, have we really cleaned out all these spirochetes in your body? And nobody can tell you for sure yes or no. There does seem to be a correlation, though, that if you get the disease and treat it very quickly, there doesn't seem to be any complications. It cleans up very quickly. It's people that did not catch it the first time that have really some long-term problems that are sometimes very difficult to turn around.
Dan?
Hey, thank you very much.
All right.
I have to stress again to you the folks out there in the public, that there are tests out there for it. It's a DNA test that they actually look for the DNA of the bug, and it's such a scary bacteria that it goes into your cell walls and comes out at different times. So you'll have good times and bad times. It's a frightening disease, and I think it's epidemic out there.
Dan, thanks for the caution. We appreciate hearing from you and bringing it up and letting Phil give us a sense of what it's like for that life cycle. Chuck in Menominee, let's go to you next. Hi.
Hello.
Yes, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a question about bees. Just yesterday we were out in the yard, my wife and I, cleaning up from the weekend storms. And as I was walking across the yard, I just happened to glance down. And as I did, out of the hole came this swarm of little very aggressive bees, and this is the third time in the last month or so that I've had one of these holes on my property. And yesterday the swarm that came out, they were particularly aggressive, and I ended up in the emergency room as a result. And what I'm wondering is, what kind of a bee is it, and is there anything I can do to get them off my property?
Well, see, I'm guessing they're yellow jackets and not bees. I mean, just the way they're behaving and whatnot. I mean, we do have bumblebees, and they can sometimes be aggressive. But if it doesn't look like a fuzzy little bumblebee, then it's most likely a yellow jacket. And we had talked about this earlier that, you know, these are basically critters that are paper wasps that nest in holes in the ground or voids. So the first thing you can do is anytime you see a gopher burrow or anything similar like that is to plug it. If it's not there in the spring, they don't have a place to set up a nest, and you're not going to see them. But if you miss this, and it's easily missed, then again, what we talk about is using a dust in the entrance of the nest. And, you know, oftentimes I tell people, you ask the question, where is the nest located? If it's out in the back 40 and nobody ever goes back there, you say, why bother with them? Because they do feed on insects and have some beneficial sides to their biology. But if it's a place where there's a lot of people and pet traffic, they are most threatened when you are close to the nest. And whether you have to mow over it or people are walking and fall into it, that can be a very dangerous situation. So you dust the nest. I think the best time to dust it is 7 or 8 o'clock at night. 7 garden dust is probably the easiest thing to find, but there's a delta methrin dust, there's a permethrin dust. Again, it's critical, I think, to use a dust. The aerosol wasp sprays work great for things that are above ground, but honestly have given us very disappointing results when we try to treat in ground. And part of it is the nest may be a foot or two away from where that entrance is. Why the dust works so well is it doesn't kill them immediately, but when they come and go, they get dust on their bodies and that does them in. And so, as I said, we've had much better success with that. So, you know, mark where those areas are, go treat them at night, or not at night, but at dusk, and that should take care of it very quickly.
And the name of the product again?
Well, the most common one is 7, S-E-V-I-N. It's a general garden dust, and you can find it at most hardware stores. I mean, almost any place you go that sells some kind of garden insecticide should have 7 dust on the shelf.
Great. Appreciate it.
All right, Chuck, good luck to you. Thanks very much. And ending up in the emergency room just seems like a frightening kind of experience after being...
Yeah, you know, part of it, they can sting you multiple times. The only thing that leaves a stinger behind is a honeybee because it has a barb on its stinger. And again, you know, if there's 200 individuals and the tragic cases I hear about, it's again, kids running around and all of a sudden their foot slips in. You know, the yellow jackets don't know any better, that they don't mean them any harm. And so they just go into a frenzy. And this happens with all wasps and bees. When one is injured or one is stinging, they give off chemicals that cause the other ones to get very agitated. And so it's kind of a building process. And although killer bees take this to the maximum, it's kind of a common behavior with wasps to be very defensive when they feel that the nest is threatened.
Phil Pelletieri is our guest, UW Madison of Entomology, and we're going next to Jason in Trigo. Hello, Jason. Hello, Jason. Jason, are you there? All right, apparently not. Let's go to Frank then in Madison. Hi, Frank. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. We recently had some work done on our attic, you know, improved the insulation in that. So it's an unheated attic, and we got some, you know, vents up through the roof of the asphalt shingles and that with some screen over it that looks like, you know, hardware cloth. Well, I have some gables there, and we wanted to improve the ventilation, so I changed some of the window panes out for a screen that had hardware cloth, quarter-inch hardware cloth across it. And it occurs to me now, should I be worrying about insects coming into that attic for a winter, even though it's unheated in that? But should I, in effect, put up some proper, you know, screen?
Yeah, I think something smaller than the quarter-inch hardware cloth. I mean, that sounds big enough that at least Asian lady beetles could get through it, maybe a couple other things, and, you know, nothing that's real serious, but can be quite a nuisance. So again, I would just suggest it to use a small enough mesh screen that it can pretty much exclude things like that.
Okay. Is there a season when those critters will be wanting to come into the attic?
1st of September to 15th of October. I mean, all the things like cluster flies and Asian lady beetles and box elder bugs, you know, they know the winter's coming because of the shortened day length. And so, again, I use September 1st as kind of the start of the invasion.
Well, thank you very much. I must have intuited that because I already went out and bought some screen to put on the backside of the cloth, hardware cloth. Well, thank you very much.
All right, Frank, you've got a week to get that up, and you should be in good shape. Joan in Green Bay, what's on your mind today?
Well, we have some kind of a tiny black bug. It's about a third of the size of a pencil eraser, and it seems to collect around the toilets and around the drains. I've put ammonia, like a cup of ammonia, in each of the drains, and the little black bugs turn to dust when you kill them. What could they be, and how do I get rid of them?
Okay. What I suspect, and when you said it turns to dust,
uh-huh.
That there's a little fly that we get that we call a drain fly or moth fly, and... they breed in any kind of slimy, damp organic matter, which is often the kind of thing you get that cakes around drains. You see them in overflow cuts in bathroom sinks. I think they're just attracted to the humidity around the toilet. They're probably not there unless you've got a toilet seal that is starting to leak and, again, get that gumpy buildup. The ammonia isn't going to get you where you want to go. In floor drains, we often start with a good, very hot pail of water to try to flush this stuff down. Bleach doesn't get you where you want to go because that doesn't eat through this stuff. In extreme cases, what you have to do is put down a chemical that is going to digest that stuff away. These drain cleaners that have bacterial digesters in them are the way to go, because what that will do is eat through that sludge, and once that gets flushed through with water, then there's no environment for these things to breed. So you have to be a little bit of a detective here, but as I said, the floor drain would be the place to start with hot water, and then we just see if that cleans the problem up, or you might have to look around for other potential sources. This morning I talked to a woman on the phone in the lab that was seeing the maggot stages of these things, and they're little blackish worms, very thin. They look a lot like mosquito larvae. She thought they were coming through in her water faucet. Well, you run way too much water. That's too clean. But again, in most sinks or whatnot, they have these overflow cuts. And if you ever look in there, it gets pretty goopy. And that's exactly the kind of place where these drain flies would breed.
What kind of a chemical and where would I get that?
Well, you're going to probably have to go to some place like Home Depot and whatnot and go under the drain cleaners. But stay away from the drainotypes, the caustic ones. What you want is a biological type, which has enzymes and bacteria in there. So they call them biofilm and biofuel and all kinds of interesting names. And it will take a little while, maybe a week or so, for that stuff to eat through. But that's the direction you want to go.
Oh, thank you so much.
All right, Joan. Thank you very much for your call. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is talk@wpr.org. Audrey in Vesper is next. Hi, Audrey. What can we do for you?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Is there some kind of chemical I can put around the foundation of my house to keep the box elders out?
Well, there's two ways of doing it. Honestly, insecticidal soap or soapy sprays, when the box elder bugs are collected, will kill them. Although I would love to tell the story. On this show years ago, I was telling people that my colleague down at Iowa State used to love a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent to a gallon of water to kill box elder bugs. And one of the callers called in and said, I tried Cheer and it didn't work. Well, it turns out soap chemistries differ, and so that's why you'll often see somebody suggest insecticidal soap. It's something that you buy at the garden store. It has the right stuff, but it is very similar to the soaps that we wash our hands with and the like, so it I think people are comfortable with. But the negative side of that is if you put it on today and they show up tomorrow, it doesn't matter. So then the other option is to go with the sprays like the Bug Be Gones and the Home Insect Controls. Those right now contain pyrethroid insecticides that if you spray them on the side of the house will last for 2 to 3 weeks. So if the bugs crawl on the surface, it will knock them down. So that would be an option, especially on the south side, the sunny side of the house where the box elder bugs like to go. That's where you'd want to spray. I don't think I would start till I saw the first one show up. You know, one of my worries right now is if you put anything on in these monsoons that come through, even though the sprays can hold up to a little bit of water, they can't hold up to 10 inches of water. And we're probably a week or two away. The other thing for those of us in the southern part of the state, it's honestly been wet enough in the last couple of weeks. I'm wondering if the box elder bugs are going to be really knocked down. They tend to do very well when it's very hot and dry. In the northern part of the state where they're still hurting for rain, it's probably going to be a bad box elder bug year. But as I said, I'm starting to get the feel for what's been going on the last 2 weeks that a lot of the bugs down here honestly will get moldy and die. They get a fungus disease that's promoted by this high humidity.
I have another question.
Mm-hmm.
I have an ant hill with redhead ants in it. Is there anything I can put on there that I don't have to worry about my dog sniffing and getting into?
Well, you know, the thing about what I find that people don't do right with ant nests is they do a little bit on the surface. In a big nest like that, really, that might go down 2 feet in the ground. And so what I often suggest is to get in there with a shovel or a rake and rake some of that dirt away. And then, especially for a very big nest, I'll even go to the point of getting a steel rod and push 3 or 4 good holes in the ground so I know I've got a channel deep in. Then I'll mix up whatever garden insecticide. I often suggest 7, as you had heard before, because it's readily available and it's got a registration for fruits and vegetables, and used to be used at one time as a flea product on dogs. There's still some labels for that. But I mix the product up in a container, and for a big nest, it may take a gallon of diluted product. you pour it on so it soaks into the ground. But then now I've got this untreated soil next to it that I can pull over it and cap it. So there's no insecticide that is up on the surface. Plus, it's an insecticide that really shouldn't pose the dog any problem. But this is a way of, you know, we don't want to expose anything to chemicals if we can help it. So this is a way that really is very efficient at treating the nest, but yet you don't have any problem with animals going out even within an hour after you treat.
Thank you very much.
All right, Audrey. Okay. Thank you. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Paul next in Eau Claire. Hi, Paul.
Hello. I have a spider I couldn't identify, about a third to a half of an inch for a body, fairly large, mostly brown. It had red leg segments close to the body, and then a black head, which was relatively small. I hadn't seen anything like that before, wondering if you had any ideas.
Boy, with spiders, it's tough. To be honest, I have to see their eyes and how they're orientated on the head to get a good idea. If you can get a bit of a picture of it, but it just doesn't ring any bells. Or I put it the other way. I can think of three or four things that would fit that description.
Okay. Well, I'll have to try to take a photo maybe for next time and send it in.
Okay.
All right.
Thank
you. Don't have to wait till next time. You can send it in as soon as you have the picture.
Yeah, as we've talked before, you know, right now 40% of what I see are digital images that people send me in the lab. And again, with the cameras, it's amazing the quality of pictures people send me. And again, so if you can get a good picture of the spider, I can probably get a better feel for it because I can see how the legs orientate and whatnot. But a lot of times, if at all possible, get that front of the face of the spider. There are 8 eyes on a spider, and depending on the size of the eyes and how they're orientated helps us identify them.
Thanks very much for the call, Paul. Our guest again is Phil Pelletieri, who is at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. He is a professor of entomology at the UW-Madison. And let's go to Peggy in Westport. And hello, Peggy.
Hello. Good morning, gentlemen. Phil, I was hoping you could help me identify this beautiful bug that was on my east-facing window the other morning. I did get a couple of pictures of it, but maybe I could describe it first. And I don't know whether it matters that it's a lakeside, so I don't know if it's an aquatic type of bug. But the body is about 4 inches long. I don't know what's the head and what's the tail. One end had 5 large legs. The other end had 5 small legs with 2 larger legs in the middle, and both ends had a set of luminescent wings.
Wow. I think it's an alien, but
it is. I've never seen anything like it before, and it's just beautiful. And I took a picture from the inside, so it's kind of into the sun, so I could, it shows the silhouette, basically.
Oh, just send it to me. If you can give me the silhouette, I think, because there aren't many things that can get in that size. I'm a little confused about the different wings. I mean, the first thought was it was a Dobson fly, but it doesn't quite fit that description. So as I said, yeah, if you could, by all means, just email it to me, and then maybe I can get a better picture of what you got. But just off the top, the wings on both sides is what's got me floored. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and real narrow body, like 2 toothpicks in density, you know, really long and skinny. And I don't know whether it was upside down, but...
Well, you know, now the thought is you may have had 2 dragonflies that were paired together.
Ooh.
You know, they would, although they, depending on how they are coupled, if it was not dragonflies, it's something else. I wonder if you had 2 of something rather than 1 of something.
I would know the dragonflies.
Okay.
Because we do get those, and I see them often. I got pretty close. I'll send you a picture because this, I'm pretty sure this is one individual.
Okay.
And send the picture to where?
Okay, my email address is a shortening of my last name. It's Pellittite at entomology, entomology .wisc.edu. You can also go to the entomology department and look up my name and get the email there, or go to the diagnostic lab website and pick it up there. But by all means, as I said, if you've got pictures, I'm happy to take a peek at them. And unlike other universities, we don't charge for that service.
Oh, okay. Well, this would be really fun to know.
All right.
Thanks so much.
We appreciate your call. We're talking with Phil Pelletieri, and we will continue to do so here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk with Phil Pelletieri about insects and bugs. And Phil, would you repeat the name of the Lyme tick prevention for clothing that you had mentioned earlier? And where can people find that?
What you're looking for is a product that is registered for clothing, not for your skin. And the active ingredient is permethrin, P-E-R-M-E-T-H-R-I-N. I know the Repel people out of Wisconsin Rapids have products that have that in it. Permanone is another name. You honestly probably have better luck at a sporting goods store of picking this up. I have seen when I go to some of the local drugstores and pharmacies that they tend to have nothing but DEET products and no permethrin-based products. And so, as I said, I know your best shot would be to go to a sporting goods store under the camping gear and stuff, and usually they'll have that there.
Mm-hmm. And box elder bugs, are they useful for anything?
Well, their purpose is to feed on the seeds of box elder and maybe make less box elder seeds out there, which is probably good. But, you know, from a human perspective, it's kind of hard to say much about them. They don't taste very well to the birds. They have that very bright color, which is usually a way an insect's way of advertising that I don't taste good. So you can't say that they feed a lot of other things out there. And again, we have seen the numbers up because of the dry summers of the last few years. If we got into an extended wet period, they would almost disappear. And so, as I said, that's what's going to be interesting to watch now, because I think we've gotten enough rain early enough that I'm starting to believe that we will not see them in the southern part of the state in the numbers we have the last two or three years.
Let's go back to the phones to Mary Jo in Hillsboro. Hello, Mary Jo. What can we do for you?
Hi. I've got a problem, a bug invasion in my garden. The bugs are sucking the juice out of my vegetables. I noticed when my green beans were starting to grow that they weren't developing. And then we went away for vacation. We came back. The beans were totally dried up and brown. And I have, you know, like on a green bean, I can have up to six of these bugs. They sort of look like a shield bug.
Yeah, they are. I know what they are, because I'd be honest, I'm absolutely deluged right now with immature green stink bugs. But what's deceptive is they're black, and then they have yellow and green stripes in the abdomen, and they have little orange shoulders to them. And why, I have no idea. We always have green stink bugs, but this year there is 50 times the number that I'm used to seeing. And mostly in the northern part of the state, I'm getting the complaints on all kinds of vegetables, flowers. They are a sucking insect. They will cause a white, cloudy spot on tomatoes. They will feed on raspberries and make them taste real nasty. They will feed on beans and peas, and the pods will not develop properly. They will even feed on fruit and cause it to distort and dimple. So those are all things they're capable of. And, you know, you see a couple, they don't get nervous. You see them ganging up on a plant, then you have to intervene. And insecticidal soap should do a pretty decent job. Most other garden insecticides will also. They're usually not hard to kill right now. What they will transform in is to an adult dark, middle green colored stink bug that's about the size of your thumbnail, which is what the adult looks like. Now, the adult flies, and so they all tend to move around and be less problematic, I think, than the nymphs, because, again, the nymphs can't fly. They lay their eggs in clusters, so usually have groups of them feeding on plants.
Right. Okay. Is the food safe to eat at all, or should we just...
Oh, yeah. Again, in the case of tomato, other than the discoloration, it doesn't seem to cause much of a problem. But I do get the complaint on raspberries that people tell me if there's been a lot of them in the patch, the berries don't taste well. And that just may be a result. These things are injecting enzymes into the plant to cause the tissue to break down. And in some cases, they even inject a yeast associated with it. And so that combination of things, I think, tend to make things taste not so good. But there's definitely not a health issue to worry about.
Okay. Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, Mary Jo, thank you very much for your call. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. Is it safe to say that this is the time of the year in which you're getting the most number of complaints, or are we still a ways off yet?
Well, and really, it starts about the end of May, and it doesn't end until, depending how the weather goes. I put it this way. I'm at the point now, and I usually get this way in the summer, is I'm praying for a frost to kind of shut things down. There have been some surprises. I'll be honest, I haven't seen as many yellow jacket problems, the ones that make it hard to eat and drink outdoors, as I was expecting. And my colleague, Bob Jean, who works with these things, has been having a very difficult time in the Madison area finding enough nests to do for his students to do research with. So there have been some surprises there. The other thing that you'll constantly hear me say is it seems like I'm living 500 miles south. I mean, all these southern bugs that I never used to see when I was a young entomologist are doing very well in a good part of Wisconsin. And we do equate this, and I think we see this with plant material now. We can plant things here that never used to be able to survive the winters because the climate has changed.
All right. Mary Jo, thank you again for your call. And on to Will in Eau Claire. Hi, Will. What can we do for you?
Hi, guys. Well, I was wondering, join your show, I'm wondering if you could talk a bit about swimmer's itch and spirochetes. When I was a kid, I rarely heard about swimmer's itch. And then as an adult, I've heard more about it. People say, oh, you know, you need to rinse off when you get out of the water from this lake because of swimmer's itch and so on. And then somebody said, well, another way to treat swimmer's itch is if you see a bit of a red blotch on your skin or something like maybe a, you know, just a little irritation. It's swimmer's itch. Prevent spirochetes from doing whatever they do under your skin there by putting on fingernail polish. And, okay. You know, I just wondered if you could fill me in a bit on what is swimmer's itch, how do you get it?
Well, swimmer's itch is something that honestly is not insect-caused. It is a parasite of ducks and geese. And it has a very complicated life cycle where it goes through snails. And typically these things are supposed to be burrowing into these other animals and not people, but they don't know that. And so what you're getting is a parasite that will burrow into your skin if you've been swimming. And why they talk about drying it off is it needs water to help it penetrate. And so if you dry yourself off vigorously, if you're in a lake or a pond that has the ducks and geese and snails, which are supporting this whole thing. So in other words, if you went in a river, you rarely hear about people getting swimmer's itch in a river because I don't think you get the right conditions to get the ducks built up and the like. And what's interesting is this little critter that burrows into you is really related to a fluke rather than being an insect. It doesn't survive, but by being present in its body being present, that's what causes the intense itching in problems with people. And it can happen usually if you've got a lake that has a history of it because of the environment, it's there every year. So you have to be careful. I think it's a little bit more prevalent in the middle and late summer than it is in the spring just because of the conditions. Now the nail polish, I think, is just a common home remedy for chiggers and anything else that itches quite a bit. And I think it's the acetone and some of the solvents in there that are working to help cut down the itch. But I think most of the time people would tell you the creams and things you get at the pharmacy are probably better things like with the Benadryl and whatnot to treat that.
Okay. Is there any, you know, lasting concern about swimmer's itch or is it, you know, whatever happens?
No, it's a short-term irritation and it's not something that is a human parasite. So there's not a problem there.
Will, good luck. Thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Pam in Tomahawk. Hi, Pam.
Hi. We've got a spider in our house that I've never seen before, and we've been there over 20 years. It's like a daddy long legs, but it is not a daddy long legs. And they come really, really small, and then they get very large, and they make a messy web. It's not a symmetrical web like a lot of spiders. In all the corners of windows, and I have like tens and twenties of them. They're all over, and I vacuum them up, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, they're there again. And it's just happened this summer.
Okay, well, what we call a daddy long legs, if you look at it very carefully, it only has one body segment, and it's not a true spider. There is both a short-bodied and long-bodied cellar spider that look almost identical, but if you look at them close enough, you see two segments to the body. There's an abdomen and then this fused segment we call a cephalothorax. So that's how you tell the difference. The other thing is daddy long legs don't make webs, as you know. And so cellar spiders, as the name implies, do very well in kind of undisturbed crawl spaces, basements and the like. It's hard to say why they're having a good year and you've not seen them before, but you know, that's, I think, a common phenomenon in biology is things are just all of a sudden things kind of fall into place. And what you're doing with the vacuuming is probably as good as anything else. Although what you may consider is I would go down in the basement and poke around to see indeed if that may be a source of part of the population and they keep spilling over into your upstairs living space. And the same thing is going along all your rafters and whatnot and get back in the nooks and crannies with a vacuum cleaner attachment, maybe is a good way to knock them down.
Okay. I did that, and they seem to be coming back again. I did that about a week ago, and they're already up in the house again.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's not a true daddy long legs, and you don't know if it's a new. I have never seen this spider before.
Yeah, well, I do see. I mean, both the short bodied and long bodied cellar spiders are common in Wisconsin, it's got to be a cellar spider from what you describe.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right, Pam. Thank you very much for the call. And Bob, let's get to you in Darlington.
Yes, Dr. Pelletieri, it's nice to talk to you again. And I've got a wonderful thing to tell you about an insect. You know the squash bug borer that ruins a lot of squash and pumpkins and cucumbers and other plants like that in that family? I've got 100% cure.
Okay.
If you do this right. And so you plant radishes, even those little red radishes or any other kind of a radish, you know, with the... With your squash or pumpkins or whatever, and it's worked for me for 25 years, and I haven't had any borers attack at all.
Okay. So the radishes are getting
That's
rid of the borers?
Well, I mean, this would be an example of companion planting where the idea is that one plant will repel the given insect. Now, are we talking about the squash bug or the squash vine borer? There's two different insects.
I don't know. That's my question, I guess. I don't know what that insect would be because I saw him when I didn't try this many years ago in my garden. I had this darn borer, and he ruined a lot of plants for me.
Okay. Well, the squash vine borer is a moth that lays her eggs, and then the caterpillars go inside, and the whole vine dies. Squash bugs, you would be much more apparent. They'd be on the surface.
We'll continue with Phil Pelletieri after we look at the latest news, and that's coming up from NPR in Washington. Good afternoon. Jim Packard sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you with us today as we talk about insects and bugs with Phil Pelletieri, who is a professor of entomology, and you'll find him at the Insect Diagnostic Lab on the UW-Madison campus. Phil, again, thank you very much for spending time with us today. And we'll go back to the phones and to Jeff in Monona. Hi, Jeff. What can we do for you?
Hi, Phil and Jim. I got a question about foundation insulation.
Okay.
I have a raised ranch in Monona. My foundation is about 2 feet out of the ground, and I'm wondering if styrofoam will provide access to bugs to get into my basement.
Not so much access, but there's two things. To be honest, down south, they would honestly say you're a fool to do this because termites have an access point. The termites that we have are subterranean termites, and they make mud in tubes, and if you put this styrofoam, they can go underneath between your basement foundation, and you never see them. We don't have that problem. But the one problem I do see quite commonly is when people put styrofoam along the outside is carpenter ants like to move into that environment. It's a soft substrate, and all they will do is excavate it. So it's not a big structural problem other than you lose your insulation quality. And I know that the manufacturers have looked at putting boric acid and other things in to prevent this. But they don't eat the styrofoam, and because boric acid is a stomach poison, to be honest, that has not turned out to be very effective. And so that's the one concern I have. It's an environment that certain things will move into, but not necessarily move in the house. They'll just take advantage of this soft stuff that they can kind of move around. Does that help?
Would you recommend any ground treatment then to keep the carpenter ants out, or would it make a difference whether I put plastic or insulcrete over the styrofoam?
I don't think it's going to matter because I think if they can get access, they will take advantage of it. The chemical side is a temporary fix. There's no chemicals that are going to last that long. Although, I'm guessing if you had a termite treatment to your house and they put some of those long-acting products in, that would protect it. But there's no reason to go through that expense in this climate. And so, as I said, you will get the benefits in the short run, but you just got to be a little careful. And if the carpenter ants show up, then you can spot treat them. In this case, again, with probably a dust, because I'm afraid that the EC-type chemicals might eat into the styrofoam. So, it's just something to consider. I know that builders have gotten away from some of this just because of some of these problems.
Very good. Thank you.
All right, Jeff, thank you very much for the call. And if you'd like to join in, the number in Madison is 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Tim in Wausau next. Hello, Tim.
Hi. I recently threw away some trash bags, which were around the perimeter of my house. And when I lifted them up, there were some swarming ant-looking insects with what looked to be one wing on their back, although I think it was just folded that way. And you may have answered this ant question earlier. I just tuned in late. I'm concerned that they may be some type of wood-eating insect. What do you think they are?
Especially at this time of the year, probably not. The call that I've been getting in the last couple of days, especially from the northern half of the state, is people seeing tremendous numbers of wing-formed ants coming out of their sidewalk or their yard. And what this is the common late-summer swarming of both cornfield and field ants do it at about this time of the year. Okay. It could also have been citronella ants. So all you did is you had an ant nest that may have moved into that environment, and then when you disturbed it, they flew off. But I'm not worried about wood-destroying ants in that case.
And just one related question. I noticed little piles of reddish-brown powder on one of my wood decks, and I wondered if that indicated some kind of wood-boring insect.
It could, although what I tend to see, how old is the deck?
Actually quite old. I'd say in the neighborhood of 10 to 12 years.
Okay. What I get calls on quite commonly is, you know, a lot of that decking wood has old wood bore holes in it from when the trees were cut. And there are various bees and wasps that will utilize those little tubes to raise their young. And they are not wood-destroying insects in the sense that they don't do the digging themselves, they don't eat the wood, but they will clean out some of this stuff. And so I'm wondering if you had one of these old wood bore holes that have been cleaned out by one of these wasps, and that itself doesn't indicate any problem. Now, if the sawdust was coarser and there were little insect fragments mixed with it, then I'd say, well, that's a sign of carpenter ants, because when they excavate the wood, they kind of throw it out in a garbage pile. But it's not powdery. It's a coarser, more little slivers would be, I think, a good way to describe it. And usually there's other material mixed with it, legs and antennae of insects, which are parts that they can't eat. They're non-digestible, so they throw it into the same kind of garbage pile.
Actually, this was very fine, talcum powder or flour.
Yeah, no, so as I said, I'm real suspicious that it's just one of those spider wasps that we talked about earlier in the show would do that, but there's a large number of bees and wasps that are looking for straw-like environments to lay their eggs and provision their nests, per se. And so, as I said, I get the same complaint in log homes, and it's not the insects burrowing into the logs, per se. They're going into holes that are already existing.
Okay, good news.
All right, Tim.
Where in Wausau could a person take an insect if you find one and have it identified? Is there anywhere in town here?
Yeah, the county extension office. To be honest, I mean, this is what my lab is set up to be the backup for, is the local county extension offices in Wausau. The master gardeners up there do an insect identification service, and when they can't identify things, they'll send the pitchers or the critters down to me. And so that's a very efficient way of getting these things done, because often you can get the answer right at the county office. And if not, as I said, they'll take care of sending the material down to me.
Excellent.
All right, Tim.
Thanks
a lot. 263-1890 is the number in Madison, otherwise 800-642-1234, toll free. And let's go next to Wenzel in Amherst. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, Jim, Phil. I think my problem may be over for the time being, but in the spring, you know, when the asparagus is starting to come up, every so often one of the stems will have, like, fresh chew marks on it, and sometimes it emerges in a kind of a normal direction. Other times it sort of looks like it distorts and it curls, and I don't know if there's something I can stick in the, you know, put in the soil to knock out whatever's causing that?
I'd be suspicious it's cutworms, because a cutworm taking a small gouge right at the surface level will cause a distortion in the spears as they grow. Cutworms are kind of hard to predict, because many of the species we've got, these are night-flying moths, and they show up one year and not the other. If they did start to show up, they do respond to the garden insecticide 7, which has a relatively short harvest interval. Permethrin probably has label for that too. But the one thing I'll tell you is keeping excess grass away. That's often what draws the cutworms in to lay their eggs, is they lay their eggs in the grasses, and then the little caterpillars migrate out from there. So for a cultural side, is the less grass that's in that patch, the better. But if it does start to show up, as soon as it starts to show up, just do one little spot treatment and you should be done.
Okay, and when you say grass, I keep it pretty weed-free, but I do mulch it, and so would that also create a nice environment for them to lay their...
Well, it, not as much, but I you know, to me, the benefits you get out of the mulch far outweigh if they may cause a little bit more of an insect problem. We do find that the more plant debris that's on an area is next to new fresh grass growth, more attractive versus barren soil, they won't lay their eggs. But as I said, I think your plants are getting enough benefit from the mulch that I would not stop mulching just because once in a while a cutworm shows up.
Okay. Well, thank you for the answer.
All right, Wenzel. Thank you very much for the call. We have some emails to run through, Phil. This is from Paul. Every October, when the city is doing leaf pickup, I have them dump a couple of loads by my garden. The following June, I spread them on the garden's mulch. Been doing this for several years with great success. This past June, when I started to fork the leaves into my wheelbarrow to spread them, I saw they were about half to two chock full of C-shaped white grubs. I assume they were scarab larvae. They were about a half to three quarters of an inch long. For fear that the larvae might attack the roots of my garden plants, I decided not to spread the leaves. Checked the leaf pile this week, and the larvae must have completed development and moved on. Three questions. Do you think the larvae would have attacked plants?
Probably not, because the kind of grubs that we find with decaying organic matter are not the ones that feed on roots. And I don't know, you know, the white grubs and Japanese beetles are our two main plant pests. And neither of them, they have more interest in lawn grass, you know, fresh growing turf to lay their eggs, and not leaf litter. So I bet you they were more a decay type of scarab than one that would be a root feeder.
And why might this happen this year and not in the past years?
Probably just even the general conditions of the mulch. In general, dry leaves are not very attractive. I wonder if it may have been a wet year or whatnot and things were starting to decay quicker. You know, more often I see these insects I see them in bark mulch piles. I see them in dead stumps. I mean, those are the kind of environments. And I think if this mulch pile was getting close to that kind of organic matter, that is what would draw them in.
And when would the leaves have been laid in the leaf pile to get larvae that large by mid-June?
Well, you know, some of these scarabs have one-year life cycles. But the funny thing is you wouldn't think by the time the piles are accumulated, we'd have much flying. And so I almost wonder if they were pre-existing in one form or another and then just moved up into the leaf itself. We see a lot of this in decaying manure, too, same type of thing. It's decaying organic matter. And so there's lots of white grubs that we get in that environment. And I wonder if there's potentially a source close by of that. The grubs themselves can't move more than a foot or two, so it has to be pretty close by.
Here's Lynn, who says, last year he put out a wasp trap and attracted honeybees. How do I get the wasps and not the bees?
Boy, that one, you know, honeybees will take a free lunch, and they are attracted to sugar. I would play around a little bit with what you use. I tend to find things like Mountain Dew Pop and things that have a lemon odor and whatnot seem to be very attractive to the wasps, but I don't see the bees being that interested.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I would play around with is changing the sugar base a little bit to have something that has some kind of, again, lemony or other odor to it, and that may just make enough of a change.
And then Carol said, I always enjoy your show, and when Phil is on, I learn so much. Now my problem is flies in my chicken coop. The fly trap I use for my barn animals doesn't attract the coop flies. Flypaper gets caught in everything in the coop, and me too. Is there anything else I can try for these coop flies? I'm an organic person and have baby guineas in the house, so I can't spray and don't even know of any organic sprays. Please help.
Well, the one organic spray is pyrethrin. But the problem with pyrethrin is it's just a knockdown type of product. I normally don't suggest this, but you may consider it in this case. They sell a trap called the Big Stinky Trap. And it honestly is a big jug that has openings on the top, and you put something in there that starts to smell pretty nasty, and it draws lots of flies. And normally I tell people that have a fly problem, I'm not so sure the flies you're drawing in are the flies that are giving you the problem. But in this case, I'm assuming you've got blow flies or other flies that are associated with the chicken waste. And you may be able to out-compete it in this case. And, you know, the trap just fills up and then you get rid of open up the jar, throw it, pour it out and do it again. And so this may be a case where a big stinky might be worth trying.
Okay. Good luck to all of you. And again, of course, our email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org. Let's go to Kay in Sauk City next. Hello, Kay.
Hi there. Last fall, I raked the leaves from my yard and piled them on the garden. And I started to spade them in and I didn't get finished before dark, and I went back out as it was getting dark and was excited to find every shovelful was full of glowworms. And I wondered if you'd talk a little bit about glowworms.
There can be two families of beetles that give us glowworms. One is called the glowworms. The other ones are the fireflies. And in the larval stage, the fireflies tend to be mostly snail and slug feeders, although they will feed on other insects. The glowworms feed on millipedes, which are another creature that's common in the soil. And the mechanism of doing light is the same. In that it is a oxidation of a protein that causes this amazing, very efficient greenish light that, I always tease students that, you touch a light bulb and we waste 90% of our energy into heat. You touch one of these things, you don't feel heat at all because about 90-some percent of the energy is converted into light and not wasted as heat. You tend to find them in moist, wooded environments, so this sounds like a very similar thing. And again, you can consider them at least beneficial when they eat the slugs, if not neutral, because millipedes, honestly, are usually not that much of a problem. And then the adult stage, of course, of the firefly people recognize, the adult stage of the glowworm is a very bizarre-looking insect. You don't even recognize it as a beetle. In fact, in the immature, the females don't even transform into a true adult. They stay in the larva form stage, so they are a worm-like creature that the male comes to mate. So it's a very interesting and unique critter. A little more common, I get the calls, like you were mentioning, you see the larvae at certain times. Rarely do I get calls that people find the adult glowworms.
This was about a half an inch long and very pale pink on the underside.
That sounds more like a firefly to me. The regular glowworms tend to be more like the mealworms that you buy in a pet store. They tend to be kind of a brownish, sometimes banded, but not the pinks, whereas some of the fireflies do have some pinkish underbellies to them.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, Kay, thank you very much for the call. 263-1890 in Madison or toll-free at 800-642-1234 as we talk with Phil Pelletieri. Let's go to Jay in Stockton next. Hi, Jay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Certainly.
I have an odd request. I live in a very, very old farmhouse, and I have lots of critters in the house here, and I have a lot of spiders, and I really don't want to kill the spiders. I know that there's problems, losing insects and things all around the world, and I don't want to contribute to that. So I have one particular spider that's in a window who has, I believe, laid sacks of eggs. Is that what that would be?
Yes, yes.
And I'd like to move her, and I assume it's a her.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that. And, take her egg sacks, put her someplace else outside or, can you help me tell me how I could do that? And is it even possible?
It should be. I think the thing is if you can capture the female and then the egg sacs, you can just, hand without any problem because they're not going to run away. To be honest, you probably don't even need to take the female with you if you just want to remove the egg sacs and take them to some other environment because there's no maternal care generally with spiders, especially the kinds that make webs. And the eggs are going to be hatching next spring and the little spiderlings are going to go off on their way. But, if you transport her to a different environment, she'll probably start to spin a web and just keep going with things. So, as I said, just get some big container and go and capture her you have to be a little quiet because she may be a little fearful and run, although some spiders have retreats they run into, and then you kind of got them surrounded. But, you should be able to move them quite easily. I mean, there's some things like bumblebee nests that you just can't, but spiders shouldn't be that hard.
Oh, thank you. That's good to know, and I wasn't sure whether there was a maternal instinct or not. So I'm glad to hear that. Again, thank you. I just really don't want to kill them.
Yeah, mm-hmm. You'll be fine.
Thank you.
Jay, thank you very much for the call, and on to Lois in Fitchburg. Hi, Lois.
Hi, Phil.
Hi, Lois.
On the front steps, the last couple of days, I've noticed some ants, and I just tuned in a little while ago, and you were talking to somebody about little slivers. Well, yesterday, I just kind of brushed all this stuff off the front steps. Well, these ants are back, and they have, it looks like little pieces of my bark mulch that they've brought back up to this little area. Is this something, they're outside, right outside the front door, something I should be concerned about?
Yeah, no, that kind of ant, they're just excavating the ground and making their nest bigger, but it's not a kind of ant that poses any kind of problems in the house. You know, if these ants were getting up underneath your siding and you were seeing little slivers come from the siding, then they say, yes, we've got an issue. But these, again, I mean, I think people are going to see a lot of ant activity, both because where it's so wet, I think they're looking for drier ground, and they will, in some cases, literally move their nests to higher ground. But in other cases, as we had talked about in the earlier part of the show, the ants are swarming now. They're coming to the surface. The queens are coming out. So you will see these little piles of wing form showing up in an afternoon, and you come back the next day and they're gone. But in this case, you know, the bark mulch, that's just a normal decomposition going on anyway. So I just don't see a problem.
Well, they're bringing it up the steps.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. But again, so, you know, if that's, you know, if it's enough of a nuisance you want to do with, then you can treat the nest. But as far as needing to, as I said, that all you're really doing is dealing with a nuisance problem.
Okay, and they shouldn't be coming in the house.
No.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you very much, Lois. We appreciate your call. Lisa in Waukesha, what's on your mind today?
Hi. About 2 weeks ago, I had an ant situation in my house. I've never seen these ants before. They are the smallest little red ant. They are so tiny.
Mm-hmm.
And they were, I had some sweet product on the counter, and they had kind of gone all the way around this plate. I talked to somebody else. They had these in their house. They were in their dog food.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I thought I had gotten rid of them. I opened up a ant product and a poison type thing, and they had eaten it, and they had gone away. Now, a couple days ago, there was two jars of peanut butter in my cupboard. Opened them up. They were in both of the peanut butters. Have no idea how they got in there, but these things are so small.
Sure. Do you live in a single-family home or an apartment? A
single-family.
Okay. There are two ants that fit that description, and the most likely one is what people will often refer to as a grease ant. Entomologists call it a thief ant, and it's an outside ant that comes in for food. And you did the right thing by trying to bait them. It just sounds like you didn't use enough bait. And so you may have knocked them back but didn't control them. There's another one called a pharaoh ant that is most likely you do not have. It has a wide variety of things it feeds in, but it nests very commonly indoors. And the name comes from its exotic ant. And although it wasn't one of the plagues of Egypt, it's like a plague. And if you had pharaoh ants, then you would need probably professional help. But I only see these in apartments usually where they're brought in and then they spread from there. So a couple things. I'm surprised, too, that they got into the peanut butter jar because you would hope that the seal would have been better on that. But that's exactly what they're after. So what I often suggest to people is to look for the baits that are made for protein or fat-loving ants, not the sweet-feeding ants, because generally these thief ants, again, don't have much of a sweet tooth. And one of the more common ones is, you know, they use boric acid and some other stomach poisons as the toxicant. But you've got to feed them enough that they take it back and feed all the other ants in the colony. And that's what people sometimes don't do, is they use them for a day or two and then they think they've got the ants. And many times it takes a couple, 3 weeks of repeated baiting to really get the effect that you want.
Okay. Yeah, and they were going down. You know, I kind of watched their line as they moved, and it went down behind the counter, which I couldn't see anymore. But they were so small that they were, I just never saw one this small before.
Yeah, that's the giveaway, that it's a thief ant. And they typically are outdoor nesters, but they can come in from 10, 15 yards away. But their nests are very hard to find, and that's why the baiting technique is a better way to do. And also, I can assure you, you know, eventually it's going to get cold enough that they stop coming in. But once they get in the habit of coming in, they can be somewhat problematic. If you see a line of ants coming, you know, and they often will make these odor trails, you can use just a little bit of vinegar and water, and what that does is chemically break up that chemical trail. But if they continue to find food, they will be back if it's a couple days. And we see them a lot in the greasier pet foods because, you know, of course, the dog food bag, we don't seal up that much. And once they get used to finding food, they don't forget where that food source is.
Then why were they by the sweets? Because that was the only thing on the counter.
Yeah, I'm guessing if there might have been just a little bit more there than, you know, a little bit of butter or something else, because like I said, if it is truly thief ants, they don't seem to have much of an interest. In fact, that's the mistake. The people that buy the Terra ant poison, which is more of a honey base with boric acid, it doesn't work because it's not the right kind of bait. And that's really the message with any ants, is try to see what they like to eat and then try to match the bait to that.
Lisa, thank you very much for the call. I'm sorry we can't get to all of the calls, but we've run out of time, and we'll look forward to Phil coming and visiting us once again. Thank you, Phil.
Thanks, Jim.
Phil Pelletier, UW-Madison, professor of entomology. He's located at the Insect Diagnostic Lab. Coming up tomorrow at 11, Garden Talk with the award-winning garden communicator, Mill Myers of Milwaukee. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard. This is the Ideas Network.